This is Charlottesville Tomorrow. Charlottesville Tomorrow is a nonprofit organization engaging the public on critical quality of life issues so we make informed choices for our community's future. Visit us on the web at seavilletomorrow.org. On November 3, 2015, voters in the city of Charlottesville go to the polls to elect their representatives to 3 seats on the Charlottesville City Council. This recording is Brian Wheeler's August 18, 2015 interview with incumbent Democrat Kathy Galvin. Other candidates in this race include Independent Scott Bandy, Democrat Wes Bellamy, Republican Anson Parker, and Democrat Mike Signer. Ms. Galvin, thank you for participating in this interview with Charlottesville Tomorrow. The complete audio recording and written transcript for this interview will be available online. Information from this interview will be used in the compilation of the Nonpartisan Voter Guide being co-produced by Charlottesville Tomorrow, The Daily Progress, and the League of Women Voters. Charlottesville Tomorrow does not endorse any candidates, and our goal is to provide information to the public so they can make an informed vote on issues primarily related to land use, transportation, public education, and community design. As you are aware, the first 2 questions you will be asked have been provided in advance. For the others, you have been provided only the topic in advance. All City Council candidates will be asked the same questions. We ask that you keep these questions confidential until all candidates have been interviewed. Each candidate will be provided an opportunity to review the excerpts selected for the voter guide before its publication. Are you ready to start?
Yes.
Question number 1. Please describe your past experience that qualifies you to be on Charlottesville City Council.
Well, to answer that question, I have to look at basically 4 different components of my life: how I was raised, my educational background, and the civic duties that I've performed over the years, and then ultimately my role on council. My upbringing in Brockton, Massachusetts was a little atypical in that it was working class, and it was in the middle of a time when all the shoe factory towns in Massachusetts were imploding. There was an economic change. So I saw a lot of jobs leave my hometown. I also saw my own family suffer from the consequences of those shifts in the economy. And the ethnic village that I grew up in was, an object of urban renewal. So I understand what it means to lose the physical fabric of your hometown. Now, what that did for me, though, is I think it kind of shaped me in my understanding of cities and made me realize how much I love them. I also got a stick-to-itiveness kind of quality from my parents that you just grin and bear it. And then with a little bit of Irish wit, you can actually make it through. I then decided to go to school in Boston. I went to Boston University and got my undergraduate degree in economics and geography, focused on all things urban. From there, I wind up getting a job working with the Boston Housing Authority as a consultant, looking at feasibility studies for the rehab of some of the most deteriorated projects in Boston. And then I did some on-site property management with assisted housing that gave me the hands-on view of what life in real dire poverty is like for our residents. Interestingly enough, I became interested in architecture at the time because I began to love buildings as I maintained them. I went to the Boston Architectural Center at night, got a portfolio together, then got accepted into the University of Virginia in 1983, graduated in 86, met my husband in 87, became a registered architect, worked in architecture for over 20 years. We had 2 children and have been in Charlottesville now for over 32 years. Have had my own practice in architecture, and that evolved into more of an urban design consulting business. So in that process, I've acquired the ability to do collaborative planning and collaborative decision-making, because I can't get anything built unless I get the engineers on board, get the specialty consultants on board, get my clients on board. So with that, and then my background in assisted housing, and I'm in Charlottesville, and Charlottesville is a very, very progressive city. I find myself on groups like the Social Development Commission, the Charlottesville Housing Foundation, and then I wind up being the chair of the Development Area's Initiative Steering Committee for Altamont County. And that was a very formative experience for me, but it was one that I really tested my skills in collaboration by bringing lots of different people together to forge a growth management strategy for Altamont County. I do believe that good growth management in the county is really good urban design for the city and vice versa. Having really wonderfully compact cities means we're not sprawling into the watershed of our region, which is good for both localities. That also is coinciding with my being a parent, and I'm on the PTO in Johnson Elementary School, and one thing leads to another. Before I know it, people are asking me to run for school board. I get on the school board thinking that's going to be only 4 years, wind up having a real appetite for policy. Given my background in urban design and development issues, people said at the end of that term, you should run for city council. You've got the experience. You've got the temperament. I don't know about the temperament, but anyway, I've got the experience. So I ran for council. I succeeded, and I'm just now completing my first term. I ran for the Democratic Party primary in June, and I succeeded in getting elected by my fellow Democrats. So now the question is, why would the general public want me to be on council for another 4 years? And I can only say that my record kind of speaks for itself. I ran on a platform of greener, smarter, stronger by design, and what that really means is making Charlottesville innovative, responsive, and effective. And how have I done that? I was the one who spearheaded the strategic investment area plan south of the downtown mall, an area that was once an abandoned industrial area, in an area that has concentrated poverty intentionally designed by the city. And we've got to open up opportunities for the population that lives there, as well as grow a vision of what the city could be. I've also pushed for the West Main Street rezoning. Yes, we all are surprised at what the zoning that was created in 03 gave us in 2011 and 2012. But I was able to then push through a process that gave rise to a very good set of recommendations that is now being used to change that zoning so that it's more in keeping with the character of Charlottesville, all the while making sure that we're not putting our city in a fragile fiscal situation. So those are just of a couple of examples. And the third example, though, is the Downtown Job Center. It was through my efforts as a member of the Piedmont Workforce Network that I began to understand that our city residents weren't using the hydraulic center. We got staff working. We got consensus on council. We've now had our own center downtown. That then has caused lots of innovation in apprenticeships, in partnerships with PBCC and other community members. We now have at least, 80 to 100 people have gone through apprenticeship programs and learning how to be a commercial bus driver, learning how to be an electrician, learning how to work in an office. All of our people who have gone through the apprenticeship programs have gotten jobs either in the hotel industry, in our own city departments, or in private sector jobs like Design Electric. So I believe that I have demonstrated an ability to get things done as well as an ability to vision and think long and execute bit by bit.
Question number two. What is your top priority for action by the City Council if you are elected?
Number one, keep the things I started in my first term going. So implementation is very, very important. Implementation is actually a function of the city executive and the city staff. We as councilors are policymakers. I think, though, one way to make sure that things I've started do get successfully implemented is that we actually have a well-functioning council. And that means that you have a council that knows what collaboration means and that understands teamwork. And I think at this point, one of the first concrete steps we could do to affect that would be get back on the job of creating our own council procedures, our council protocols for conduct. We started that a year ago, hasn't been finished. That would have clarified roles between the city manager, the council, and the mayor. It would have also given us really strong guidelines on how to conduct business with our advisory committees, as well as how to form our own committees as councilors that could then in turn develop collegiality. I think the other thing is that we've got to create a better citizen complaint tracking system. I have been on that since my second year on council. And if you can imagine, if councilors are always responding to complaints, you know, it could be anything from a pothole to not having a clear enough striping for a crosswalk to speeding on a certain street. And if you have your city manager also working on answering emails and complaints, then city council isn't doing the vision thing, and then the city manager isn't doing the strategic planning thing. We've got to make sure that we get automatic systems in place that can take in the complaints, dispatch them to the appropriate departments, and that we counselors get a report that tells us how effectively and how quickly we've been responding to those complaints. That way, we will all then be able to do the roles that we are really intended to have. Again, council vision, city manager execution, staff all execution. That way, council will be much more clear in the directives it gives to its city manager. I think I've really worked hard at improving our systems of accountability. I pushed to get in place a city manager evaluation tool that's objective and measurable. I think the whole point of having a strategic plan, which I pushed for, was to have performance metrics. Those are also priorities of mine to make sure that we keep our kind of evaluation tools up to date and always in use. So I think that would be the last thing I'll say is part of keeping us responsive as well as effective and innovative is that we must have a commitment to genuine community engagement. And that community engagement has to permeate the culture of every department in the city. And it has to begin, again, at council level. We have to be engaged ourselves with each other and with the community. There are many things that we could be doing better in regard to that, but also I was the council that put in place these major planning efforts, but also coincident with that, steering committees, citizen steering committees. We need to keep doing that, and we need to be ongoing with that, because every time, you know, we have a development project now, we have major controversy in the community, and yet we have got to redevelop. We have got to redevelop our corridors, or else we won't maintain fiscal well-being. And we won't provide jobs, and we won't provide housing, and we will become an extremely exclusive, expensive place to live.
Question number 3. What steps should council and the school board take to help build a more sustainable school budget?
Well, I pushed for the Blue Ribbon Commission over 2 years ago now, and over a year ago, a report was handed to the council. That report has yet to be scrutinized and then translated into policies and actions. The one thing we did do was wind up raising our meals tax 1%. I believe we were put in a position last year that was in a way caught by surprise. We didn't have the resources to balance our budget. Councilors kept adding to the services that we would deliver. I saw no other choice but to raise the tax. Going forward, the Blue Ribbon Commission did give us some pretty good non-tax revenue strategies to raise revenue. One of them was to reassess how we do our assessments. I think we have got to take a serious look at that process. I've been assured by our city manager that's happening, but we've seen nothing yet. before us. So that was a major recommendation of the Blue Ribbon Commission. I want to see that done. I want to see the results. The other thing that we need to do is really be focused on increasing home ownership in the city. We're at something like 38% of our housing stock is homeownership, and comparative to the state of Virginia, that's at 65%. We're really low. Now, we're a university town, but we need to take advantage of the fact that with the student housing that has been growing, we have now what has been kind of a single-family detached housing type is now freeing up in our neighborhoods. We need to actively engage in transforming them back into single-family homes that can be available to anybody of any income level with the right supports. So the other thing that I, part and parcel of that, is to expand workforce housing. We have something like 30,000 people that work in the city, and only 7,000 of them live here. That creates a huge commute problem, both in terms of traffic and air quality and runoff problems with our rivers. So I think solving that problem, expanding within our city every different kind of housing type to accommodate home ownership, from small lot housing, single family detached, to townhouses, to condominiums, I think will be very beneficial to the city, and also let a lot of the people that work for the city and in the city live in the city. The other thing that was brought to our attention is that we're not collecting fees from small landlords. Small landlords in the city that lease to students. That means we don't get any money for business licenses, and we don't have any access to those buildings to do inspections. That leaves the students vulnerable, the neighborhood vulnerable, and it means that the city's not getting revenue. And finally, it's something that I think is long overdue, and it was recommended by the Blue Ribbon Commission. We need to really understand what we're losing in terms of tax revenue by the fact that the city, that the University of Virginia owns a lot of the property in the city. The payment in lieu of taxes, the pilot is a device that's used all over the country. Yale, for example, pays a pilot New Haven. We do get compensation for our bus service, for example, and for some of our fire department services. But I think we need some engagement with the university in a much more concerted way to look at what we need by way of additional revenue, our in-kind, for example, working with us to build that workforce housing. For example, working with us to improve our infrastructure like West Main Street. This is a partnership, and we need to start getting to the table more often to see where we can actually work together. Those were the non-tax revenue generating recommendations from the Blue Ribbon Commission. And I think if we start doing that, we're going to start seeing more stronger revenue streams coming into the city without raising any more taxes. And then the 1% meals tax that we raised last year was that magic $2 million a year that Blue Ribbon Commission said that was the ongoing shortfall every year.
Question number 4. Business leaders and social service agencies have told local government that new investments are sorely needed in the area of early childhood education. Will you make pre-K education and quality child care a priority, and if so, how?
We're in a wonderful situation in the city of Charlottesville for the first time in a long time that we're seeing enrollment increase. When I was on school board 5 years ago, we were kind of at our low point, like 3,700 students. Now we're like 4,200 students. That's a considerable increase. That's telling me that young families want the walkable city. They want what Charlottesville provides. That's the good part. What we also need to understand, though, is that across the board, is that not every child is succeeding in our city schools the same way. I have learned over the years that a lot of that is attributed to the neighborhoods that the students are growing up in. It's different if you're living in a neighborhood that has parks, that has sidewalks, that feels safe. You're not in danger of any kind of harm, as opposed to living in a neighborhood that has got food deserts and park deserts and actually could have high levels of violence. So we've got a situation where how are we going to rebalance the time after school and the time before school, since about 87% of a child's life is not in school at all? So that's one thing that I'm expanding the question a bit. We need better after-school programming. Now, those same neighborhoods and those same circumstances for the more affluent children also are the ones that give them the most rich early childhood education. I was able to send both my children into a lovely church preschool program, which was delightful, absolutely delightful. I know that doesn't happen for all of our children. We are fortunate in the city to have a four-year-old program for our high-risk children, and for certain select few, we are able to do the three-year-old program. But while we are now looking at the wonderful problem of having to actually expand the physical capacity of our schools because of a growing enrollment, and you've got this growing need now to actually expand pre-K education to everybody, at least all three-year-olds, then I think we need to think about a very robust capital improvement program. When I was on school board, we had the reconfiguration plan, which was an opportunity to get all the fifth grade back into the elementary schools. It was then consolidating 6, 7, and 8 at Buford, and then it was going to be using Walker as a state-of-the-art early childhood development center that could have considerably expanded our options for early childhood development. And I stress that it is early childhood development, not only daycare. This is state-of-the-art enrichment. And work at a partnership with the Curry School. Robert Pianta is an expert in early childhood education. There has now been there's been a summit between the various daycare providers and the school divisions on early childhood education. I think now the time is right to get the right people in the room to start tasking out the steps that are going to be needed to create both the physical plant as well as the staff resources to get this done. So once we know what our trending is for sure, what our growth needs are, then we can start looking at, together with the county, what we need by way of resources in terms of the physical plant, that means capital budget needs, as well as then programming needs. I think I'm hoping at some point we could even move towards a model where it's a regional approach so that city children and county children are going cross-border. And let's use the early childhood development program as the first step towards greater sharing in our division, because we don't have it yet. We don't have all these other systems in place that need to be broken for us in order to tie them together. This would be a brand new way of delivering services and both jurisdictions learning to do it together.
Question number 5 on citizen input. Each growth area in Albemarle County has a community advisory committee appointed by the Board of Supervisors, which provides input on program and policy decisions, including the implementation of the comprehensive plan. In what ways would you like to see city government engage neighborhoods to ensure a diversity of voices is involved in the implementation of the city's small area plans?
Well, I can happily say that because I was the one who initiated the first small area plan in the city, which is the strategic investment area, I was also the one that initiated the first small area planning citizen steering committee. That has had never been done before in the city of Charlottesville. And so, you know, we've had advisory groups, but never had a steering committee tasked with working with the outside consultant and our own staff to basically shepherd through a vision plan for a piece of geography, a real tangible piece of geography in the city. The comprehensive plan document, as we all know, is filled with lots of really great statements, a lot of platitudes, but it is that small area plan that starts putting that abstract idea into a concrete kind of visualization. And so that That is a first step. We had a lot of bumps in the road, but it was because of that steering committee that was very diverse. It had public housing residents. It had business owners. It had residents from Belmont and Ridge Street neighborhoods, downtown, north downtown residents. And it was also very well attended for the most part. And they were also the ones that kind of helped create the guiding principles for the document. So that was the first case of a steering committee. Because we're about 18 months behind, though, in implementation of the strategic investment area, that steering committee has not met. I'm one of the first things I would like Mr. Ikifuna to do, our new Director of Neighborhood Development Services, is to resurrect that process. I think one of the biggest things in terms of citizen input that we would need in that area of town is, okay, we've got it now adopted and part of the comprehensive plan. Now, it's supposed to get its own zoning. It's supposed to get a zoning overlay. We need to make sure what the public knows and understands about that, and the public needs to really weigh in on what that means. Zoning is a tool. It's a tool for the vision. It's not an end-all, be-all. It is a means to an end. Unfortunately, in most communities, and Charlottesville is no different, zoning is what begins to be institutionalized and established that seems to be impossible to change. And all we do is keep going through the motions of changing the vision every 5 years. So I'm looking at, in that specific case, the community input needs to be revived, and we've already got the structure in place. We have a citizen steering committee for the Belmont Bridge. The Belmont Bridge, though, however, is a couple of years late. The RFP hasn't even gone out yet to the consultant. That means we've lost about $2.5 million in state money. That is a priority to get that bridge built, and thankfully we do have a citizen steering committee made up of Belmont residents as well as downtown businesses and people who have expertise in design. West Main Street Steering Committee is still in play, and last night in the council meeting they were brought back in to participate in working through some additional changes that the council will likely put in place. So I see that as something that we constantly need to improve upon. In large part, I think we need to improve upon the facilitation of those steering committees so that we're not just pulling together people of different interest groups that then duke it out in the room. We've got to create professionals with the skills and then empowered to do so, to forge consensus with people in the room. So that, to me, will be the next step for I would like to see us move towards, is that our own staff have the skills to both facilitate and then they feel empowered to facilitate groups to reach consensus.
Question number 6. Describe a part of local government that would benefit from increased cooperation by the city, county, and or the University of Virginia, and that you would make a priority.
Well, first, I want to say that I feel very proud of the fact that I have already, in many ways, created goodwill between the city and the county, in large part because of my efforts as a board member of the Rivanna Water and Sewer Authority Board. 2 years ago, we slogged through a very, very hard cost allocation agreement to pay for the wastewater projects for our shared authority. But that process, and I had called for a professional mediator to come in so that we could really get beyond our parochial interests, and I also called for an outside consultant to come in and confirm that the cost allocation formula that we created was prudent and actually reflective of good industry practice, and it was. So that achievement gave rise to the Alma County, the Service Authority Board agreeing to pay for the relocation of the pump station in the Woolen Mills. That had been a very contentious issue And instead, it now is, as we speak, the tunnel is being built. It is now going to be over at the Rivanna Water and Sewer Authority's treatment plant, where it should be. And that has then given rise to also a comfort level, so that now, last year, we agreed as a board to put capital monies into an odor mitigation plan for the treatment facility that will benefit several city neighborhoods, as well as the areas on the Pantops region for the county. So I just say that because that's very, it's very important that we demonstrate trust, the ability to trust, and the ability to get things done. And then that kind of feeds into further willingness to work together. I see that a big area that we could benefit from is in the area of transportation. And I've been working with Brad Sheffield and Diantha McKeel on that. And as you know, we well know that we have a regional economy, so jobs are in the county that city residents go to, and vice versa, although more county residents commute into the city. I would love to see more job centers in Amaw County, actually, so that we do more reverse commuting as well. But that would mean, especially for our low-income residents, that we have a very robust regional transportation system. And that's we already have the authority due to the approval of the General Assembly, but we need to then figure out a way to raise the resources to do that. Related to that transportation piece, I think we are really missing some opportunities to do regional bicycle networking. I think that there is one of the candidates for Amaw County is extremely interested in bike networks and off-road and on-road facilities. I certainly have several people in Charlottesville that want to work with the county on that, and I'm actually already brought people together to do that. And that will be exciting if we can start imagining cycling around and through the city using cycling as a commute mode, not only recreation. And I already talked about the early childhood. I think that's the other area that is really important that we partner in and start doing it from the get-go before we start establishing our own proprietary kind of fiefdoms. This would be right from the beginning. Let's start a regional early childhood development program and then pool our resources together so that it's excellent programming for all of our children. And we know darn well that poverty knows no boundary. The poverty levels are rising in the urban ring around the county as fast, if not faster, than Charlottesville today.
Question number 7. What role should City Council play in decisions about good urban design and placemaking?
I can say the role that Council has played, and one of the early acts on Council was that I put forward the resolution that enabled the Place Design Task Force. PLACE stands for Placemaking, Livability, and Community Engagement Task Force. The first year's annual report was what gave city staff and city council direction to do the West Main Improvement Program, to move forward with a robust community engagement strategy that should be codified eventually and put in policy. I had already been pushing for a comprehensive review of our street network and looking at how we can make our streets multimodal, but it was the Place Design Task Force that said, use this as an opportunity to also look into green streets. We are a system of peaks and valleys in the city, so that we're really primed to take advantage of the grade changes to know where are those areas where you can actually filter the runoff from our streets through the kind of plantings and street trees that you put on those streets, so that instead of always investing in hard pipe, we're actually investing in something that is doing double duty, cooling the street, making it attractive, but also cleaning the runoff before it heads into our rivers. So I think that is an example of having a task force of technically expert people that understand the interface between the built environment and the public space. And that was something that was a skill set that was missing in our staff. And it was also a body that understood comprehensive planning. We have multiple departments. Again, it's something that plagues lots of governments where everybody stays in their silo. But by having a group that was looking at comprehensive, holistic planning approaches, it was inherently pulling different departments together and getting the departments to work together. The group also reviews RFPs so that the request for proposals for any projects are really giving us what we want in terms of a consultant. So in a way, it was like a built-in peer review team that it was to help staff to really be exposed and to inculcate best practices in urban design and placemaking. So that said, now the hard work is to implement, okay? So they helped us come up with the initiatives. They helped us move forward with the code audit, for example. We've just got to get the code audit done. We've got to get the Streets That Work project done. We've got to do the rezoning in the strategic investment area. That now is up to the city to do. But at least we've got the tools are increasingly in place. And I think, again, with finally getting a new director of Neighborhood Development Services, someone with experience in small area planning, someone with experience with excellent community engagement practice, we're going to start seeing things happening. You got to give the person time to acclimate, certainly, but I'm extremely hopeful.
Question number 8. What is your top transportation priority, and how will it be funded?
Well, you know, nothing's always just one priority, but I guess I'll say top priority in terms of different scales. I think a top priority for me at the very local scale of the city block network is to get West Main Street completed. That is a major, major link between a World Heritage site, that is the university's lawn, and one of the most successful pedestrian malls in the country, the Downtown Mall. Two pedestrian generators, and it really is crying out to be not only a safe street, but a comfortable, beautiful street that can be beautiful and safe for cyclists, for walkers, for motorists, and for people that take the bus. That's a major priority for me. The second tier or scale would be we've got to complete the Streets That Work initiative. Now, the Streets That Work initiative is we've got tool design working with staff. They've done an assessment of the conditions of all of our streets in terms of safety and from a pedestrian and a cyclist standpoint, and had lots of feedback from the public so that they've identified really the hot spots in the city. The next step will be to set priorities for what needs to be looked at first. They've got a hierarchy of streets, meaning their framework streets, which are going to be the biggest streets that make sure that all the emergency vehicles can get through, and then the non-framework streets are the ones that need to be very, very slow. And then they're giving us a toolkit on how do you slow down a street. It's not just a speed bump anymore. There are very good ways to slow down a street that's effective and also attractive. So this was born in direct response to the countless town hall meetings we had since I've been on council, where 80% of the complaints were about speeding, were about close calls with being hit by cars, with even with cyclists not obeying rules, and bad signage, and truck routes not identified. And so that's what gave rise to the need for this comprehensive plan that also gives us the detailed toolkit to fix the streets as the priority tells us to do so and as the resources are available. So the last tier of transportation is actually regional, and we talked a little bit about that already with regards to Alma County. But I do want to hit home the fact that you, when you're looking at a regional level, it's not only transportation, you've got to look at land use. And so I am very focused on creating a workforce housing policy and strategy to increase the housing choice within the city so that more of the people that work here can live here, including our own city employees and including our city employees. And that is actually getting closer and closer to being a reality because I was able to secure funding through our housing fund to do an investigation of our workforce housing needs. And tomorrow, the consultant who came out of the West Main Street team is going to be kind of giving us some information about really what the demand for the workforce housing is. So we're going to get a sense of what the demand is, and then we can create a policy that to incentivize the workforce housing. And that has to be going hand in glove with solving our transportation problem because, again, the traffic, the smog, everything is related to the fact that we are a jobs magnet in the region right now, and we don't actually have enough housing for those employees. And, you know, again, working with the county, they create more clusters and nodes of job centers using the neighborhood model, then we'll create options for our people to have more job choice in the county.
Question number 9, what areas of the current comprehensive plan will you concentrate on for implementation, improvement, and or monitoring?
Well, I think the big overarching concern that I have about the comprehensive plan is that our public doesn't know anything about it. It makes me concerned about how we do our comprehensive plan updates, but that's what I've been learning. So my big thrust moving forward is going to be, especially as we update this next comprehensive plan, is having a very close-to-the-ground approach going into every neighborhood we can to really get people to express what they view is the vision for the future of the city of Charlottesville. Again, that's where there's a big disconnect. Whenever council is reviewing a development project and we are following what we call our standards of review, and if there's a change, if the owner is making a change in the zoning, we have to go back to our comp plan. If it meets the comp plan, then we say, okay, then this makes sense. But if the public doesn't understand what the comp plan is and doesn't buy into the vision, that's a problem. And then secondarily, if the public thinks that they can change zoning by, you know, presenting a petition to council, they're not understanding the law of Virginia. I guess only in California everything's done by referendum. But even then, that has a much more precise process. So I would like to really move forward with expanding the community's understanding of how they can change zoning. And the comprehensive plan that we have today talks repeatedly about making sure our zoning is implementing the vision. It talks about form-based codes as one potential tool to be explored. So that means to me we've got to do lots of ongoing community engagement about, well, again, what is zoning? What's the comp plan? How can a community legally change its zoning without running afoul of private property rights? And you can do it through a small area plan, like the strategic investment area. You can do it through a comprehensive rezoning. That's why I push forward the code audit to kind of look at the whole zoning ordinance in total. And then you can also look at it by changing an existing district's zoning, like we're doing at West Main Street. So we're doing all of it. The public just isn't aware of it. The public is screaming for different kind of built outcomes. We're trying to do that through changing of zoning, and yet the public doesn't understand the role zoning plays in all of this. And that to me is the area, quite honestly, that I want to focus on in terms of the comprehensive plan, just understanding it and understanding how it's implemented.
Question number 10. What specifically should City Council do to promote employment, and what types of jobs will be your priority?
Well, again, I can happily say that since I've been on council, I have I have been probably the biggest voice for ending poverty through employment on council. As I was a member of the Piedmont Workforce Network, as I said earlier, and I realized the pattern of use of the state's resources, and when we finally got our own workforce center downtown, there was a huge uptick in city residents availing themselves of the resources that you get at a job center. And the population needs in Charlottesville are different in many ways than the surrounding counties. We do have about a third of our working age population has a high school diploma or less. So I can't simply be focused on what they call the target industry jobs. The target industry jobs was based on a study that we received a few years ago that clearly said that we're a high technology environment, strong on innovation and creativity, that we've got to keep bringing in biotechnology, information technology, medicine, education, certainly the arts. I definitely am all for that as well because, each biotechnology job has a multiplier effect of like three jobs to support it. But I would be committing a disservice to our public if I did not understand that we got to create ladders of opportunity out of poverty for folks that don't even have their GED at this point in time. So I have worked diligently and successfully in creating GED prep programs in our public housing communities, for example. Then I've worked with PVCC and our city employment specialist to create a program called Plugged in Virginia, where people with a high school diploma get certifications that make them competitive with people with college degrees to do jobs that don't need a college degree. That's your managerial levels that you often find throughout all of our hotels and our stores. And then we've created, as I've said earlier, the apprenticeship programs for people in the trades. That is exactly what I want to expand. And I see moving forward, my goal will be using now the infrastructure we've put in place with apprenticeships, with our working partnerships with PVCC, to then ramp up and focus on getting as many of our public housing and very low-income residents qualified to actually participate in what they call the Section 3 program. It's a HUD program that says for any project that is HUD-owned, that is redeveloped, 30% of that employment need should be met by a qualified low-income resident. The operative word is qualified. And in many ways, this is what's been driving me with all these programs, is to create those systems that now we can plug into solving that problem as we enter in a phase where we're going to redevelop public housing.
Question number 11.
Oh.
Do you support the redevelopment of Charlottesville's public housing sites to create vibrant, mixed-income, and mixed-use neighborhoods without displacement of existing residents?
Absolutely. That is in the principles of the Strategic Investment Area Plan, black and white. Mixed-income communities without displacement. So all 340 units of assisted housing, that includes the Friendship Court housing in that strategic investment area, the city has said, and it's now in the comp plan, they are committed to preserving those. Now, that doesn't mean that there's only going to be that housing in those neighborhoods. It does mean that we're going to have that in the mix. And what we're also learning, and this was also written into the Wallace Robertson Todd study that was done to redevelop public housing 5 or 6 years ago now, maybe even longer, that also had as its guiding principles mixed income communities. However, the goal is also to have programs in place to promote self-sufficiency. We have that now with all the apprenticeship programs we've created, with all the connections we've made, with the job center that we've got. That is now in place. We could not ensure that we would be promoting self-sufficiency for our very low-income folks unless we had that. We have that now. And it's a really exciting opportunity because people don't have to stay low income forever. And I think that's been a thought stuck in people's minds, that you're always going to be in this economic strata for your entire life. And when you look at people that have lived in assisted housing, it can be the third and fourth generation. But if you've read any of the social science about the great economic displacements of our times, when manufacturing left, and the Ix building is an example, it was a textile manufacturing plant, made parachutes. When that left, when the Better Living Millwork shop left, when they no longer hired many people on the railroad, and in the county when ConAgra closed, all those manufacturing plants that did not require more than an eighth grade education, that left a lot of people behind. And it's kind of, we're coming full circle in our conversation. That is what I grew up in. That's what I saw in Brockton. I saw, as a 10-year-old girl, a bustling, robust city that I could take the bus to go downtown on Main Street and enjoy the parades and back-to-school day shopping. And then by the time I was in high school, that Main Street was shuttered. There was only shopping malls in the four corners of the city. And I saw, slowly but surely, every shoe factory leave town, go to parts in Asia or parts south. That's what happened to Charlottesville in a smaller scale. And so the kinds of jobs we need now to get people out of poverty are going to be getting back to the blue-collar job. And redevelopment, the construction trades, are a surefire way to get on those rungs of that ladder in the working class. And again, one of the partnerships we're talking about at PVCC is there are several state registered apprenticeship programs in heating and cooling, in plumbing, and electrical. We start doing what we're doing with our own apprenticeship programs, we can start getting our folks into those programs, which then give them options all over the country. So I think using the redevelopment of our public housing sites as an economic mobility engine, now that we have the frameworks in place to get people the skills they need, to get people the supports they need to stay on task, because we do need to provide that excellent daycare. We do need to provide services for folks that need transportation. We do need to understand there are folks with serious mental illness that we need to address. But all that's been tested now. We've got it working. So, yes, I am committed, the city's committed to creating vibrant, mixed-income neighborhoods of upward social mobility. People aren't going to have to stay in the place they were born in. And then, you know, it's kind of Charlottesville's calling card. We love being diverse. We're not going to have any problem with people living cheek and jowl with different income classes in this city. This is what makes Charlottesville great, and it's a great place to live.
Kathy Galvin, thank you for participating in this interview with Charlottesville Tomorrow.